Welcome to Pamela Sigdinos, author of Silent Sorority, blogger, and author of a new Kindle book, Finally Heard, A Silent Sorority Finds Its Voice, and mentor and role model for many of those, like myself, struggling to come to terms with infertility and childlessness. So, welcome, Pamela.
Thank
Perhaps
you,
you could
Leslie.
start, just tell us a little bit about Finally Heard.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and also to the folks who follow your blog and your Twitter account. And I think we're building a really interesting and multi-dimensional community here, which I'm really happy to see. For a very long time, women who did not succeed with treatment were sort of hiding in the background, and for good reason. You know, we had a fair amount of trauma to work through, and I know you and I have chatted about this in the past. And there are not really good tools and good ways to help people who are facing this very difficult transition in their life. That's one of the reasons why I've continued to blog and to write and to really engage with people who are interested in understanding what happens and what is available to women and men who are really trying to figure out how to move through a lot of the pain and sadness and anger to a place of peace and acceptance.
I think I would describe your writing as quite bold in the book because you've been blogging and you're an author for a few years now. You can say things that the rest of us probably haven't got the courage to say, and you call out the industry in some ways. You point out that there's 1.1 million failed cycles. So what would you say the key messages that were from the that you want people to take from reading the book?
Well, you know, there's a set of players in all of this, right? There are the individuals. There are the people who are either finding out through a variety of means that they're biologically incapable of having children on their own. There are those who are older and are facing just the very facts of life that as you age, your body is just not as fertile as it once was. And then there are a whole host of medical and healthcare providers, all of whom are involved in trying to decode this mystery, right? Is it biological? Is it age-related? Are there some unknowns, right? There's still a lot people in the science
Absolutely.
and research community don't understand. So I think there's a couple of things that I can address here. The first is it's really important for people to have an honest and open understanding of what their particular physical makeup is, and that through a primary care physician, a gynecologist who just, you know, works with people on a regular basis and understands the biology. They're the most, I would say, objective in helping us to understand what are we dealing with. The second are the providers who are in the business of trying to sell procedures and treatments. Some of them have our best interests at heart, and I'm not going to impugn the entire industry because clearly some people have been helped. But there are also those who are in the business of keeping procedures going, right? So the biggest shock that I had as I came out of my own emotional turmoil was understanding just how little time and energy is spent in helping couples resolve the fact that they may actually never succeed with treatment. So rather than encourage them to move through some of the emotional reconciliation, to provide counseling, to really give an understanding, language and etiquette to society to help people, they just keep upselling. So they'll move to another procedure. They'll ask if there's an interest in pursuing donor eggs and donor sperm, which, you know, creates a whole nother set of complexities, which we can get into at some point. But I guess my larger message is nobody has really applied a level of scrutiny and accountability to say, are we acting in the best interest of both the patient consumers and the children who may one day be conceived, who may be compromised because there are just not enough health studies. Premature births are a huge concern. Mm. I mean, there's so much to talk about. It's hard to know where to begin.
Yeah, I think for myself, we made our own decision to stop when I was 40, and that was it. That we were never contacted by a clinic ever again. We were not offered any help or support. I think in the UK you might get some level of counselling, but there's nothing to stop you going to another clinic and another clinic and another clinic. And I think, you know, that as you say, not all clinics are like this, but majority are selling. Well, they're all selling, and they will just keep selling you something else. And there's no, well, what about having a childless, child-free life? There's just no consideration of that. So that's a valid point, really. Is it, what do you think that the clinics could do? What would your wish would be for the industry in that part?
Well, I think that there are a set of things that can be done. First and foremost, it would be really refreshing and I think remarkably important for those who are in the industry. There are industry associations that are out there to really take a very hard look at the practices and behaviors of those who are providing fertility services.
Yeah.
You know, these memberships live in these organizations. So in order for a member to be a part of one of these professional services organizations, I think they should have a code of conduct,
sure.
You know, a real sense of accountability. Is your first priority to be of help, to do no harm? And do no harm also means looking at the whole person, not just the biological reproductive organ. Sure, you can look at a uterus, you can look at, you know, a sperm test, but the reality is those organs are attached to people who have hearts and minds and expectations.
Absolutely.
Are you sitting down with the individual and helping them to understand the gravity and the challenges that may be ahead of them?
Yeah.
You know, most people want to push a piece of paper at you that says, do you have the finances to pay for this?
Yes.
Have you absolved us of any legal problems? Should there be any complication down the line? So the legal papers are there, the financial papers are there, but there's nobody who says, we want to make sure that we are in a position to guide you in a very meaningful way through the very real possibility that these treatments may not work,
yes,
and that you may come away without the outcome that you're clearly here to pursue.
I think you're absolutely right. We have the, in the UK, there's the human HFEA, the Human Fertilisation Embryology Authority, if I can say it right, and they do. There's a level of scrutiny, and every time they do surveys, it says, they say, you know, that there's nothing. It's not the whole person, it's just the medical side, but I don't know that they force the clinics into doing an awful lot different. I don't know if you've read Jessica Hepburn's book, The Pursuit of Motherhood.
I mean, I have.
Yeah, I mean, she mentions...
She's remarkable, yeah.
Yeah, and she mentions that in there, doesn't she, that she didn't have any help for her head and what she was going through. So, yeah, that would be lovely if that happened, wouldn't it?
Well, and it's been, you know, it's been 37 years since IVF was available. And in 37 years, we have gained a lot of knowledge and an understanding. And I think it's really quite appalling that we've gotten to this stage of development with 37 years of procedures being available and nobody who has put together an in-depth study that looks at what happens when these procedures don't work. How do you provide a multidimensional treatment that looks at the physical, the emotional, and the overall, you know, lifestyle aspects that people have to deal with?
Yes,
because we don't live in isolation. It's not a surprise to clinics that people come away traumatized. And to pretend otherwise, which I think is what's been happening, because it's easier not to acknowledge it than to address it.
It is, absolutely. Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's certainly... And in the 37 years, the success rate hasn't markedly changed, has it, really?
No, it has not. And again, it comes back to some real fundamentals. And I know there's lots of discussions out there about forcing women into decisions of having children before they may be ready mature-wise and the like. But rather than get into the public policy debate of what's the right age to get pregnant and how young is too young, I think we're better off giving people an understanding of the fertility spectrum. There are some people who are in their prime childbearing years who are going to have difficulty. There always have been, there always will be. And instead of getting into these debates that end up becoming religious and political, let's be honest and concrete about what are you dealing with. And then society-wise, let's acknowledge that there are going to be a percentage of the population who, despite science and Mother Nature, will never have children. And let's embrace and also make them welcome, not marginalize, not create this environment where if you're not a parent, you don't matter. I mean, there's all these competing messages out there at the same time that we're bombarded by all these stories of people having children at older and older ages. They are the outliers. They're not the norm.
And often if they're celebrities, maybe they don't always tell the whole truth, do they? So it's difficult to know. But sometimes people, you know, the woman has babies at 50, 55. Well, that was probably donor eggs, donors, who knows? But they don't always tell you the whole story. So it raises that false expectation that it will be okay if you leave it. And it might, but it might not.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And let's be honest, you know, the reality of being human these days is we are going to face disappointments in our life. Not everything is going to work out the way we hope. But that doesn't mean you cannot reconcile and find some opportunity to work through all of the challenges and emotions that might come with that. I know you've talked with Tracy Cleantis and her book, The Next Happy. You know, there are multiple opportunities to give people room to grieve the sadness and the despair that they feel in not being able to have their own child. But as you and I have talked about, once you've tackled that and gotten through the worst of that dark period, you can come out on the other end, assuming you've gotten adequate support and guidance and empathy. There's just compassion. It's free. That's the thing that people don't understand.
So would you, what would you like to do to raise that understanding? What can we all do, those of us that are in the community that are, you know, standing tall in our story?
Well, I think, you know, back to your original question about what the industry can do, I think the industry needs to start first and foremost with an acknowledgement. There would be a real interesting shift in where expectations and perceptions are if the industry had on their websites and in their marketing materials a real clear, true, authentic picture of what's possible. So rather than just market the heck out of beautiful, cuddly babies, let's take another look at the reality of the human spectrum in biology. So changing the marketing would be one. The second thing I would say is, given the amount of money that these clinics are earning, and there are studies now proving that they become cash cows for universities to fund huge amounts of other programs that have nothing to do with fertility, put a percentage of those earnings toward some fund that really does support emotional studies, long-term health, you know, give women, you know, the opportunity to connect with other people. Obviously, money is the crux of the matter here. We all do this as volunteers. None of us are earning anything by talking about this, by writing about this. But if there were some funding available, grants made available to give people a better understanding of what's ahead of them and how to plan a life that may be different than the one they had originally thought through, here you go. There's plenty of opportunity.
I think they you listen to the Radio 4 program that was broadcast recently, Drawing the Line, and I think that was, I know the Woman's Hour phone-in had quite a lot of success stories, but I do feel that the documentary was a bit of a step change for the industry, and in that it did show the real what it's really like to go through IVF, and that you can have a happy life afterwards without children. I'm not sure it was probably very popular by the clinics, but you know, it's a first step, I think, certainly in the UK.
Definitely. And I do think that the UK is a leader in acknowledging, because they do have an oversight accountability that does not exist in other countries.
Sure.
And specifically in the United States, where it shocked me to find out that somebody would have a harder time getting a license to open a food truck than they would to open a donor egg agency,
wow.
which just mind-blowing. But beyond that, back to your question, I think that there are another set of individuals who are stepping forward. The BBC obviously has spent some time looking at what are the underlying issues that are not being addressed. I've talked to a few young reporters here in the United States who are in their 20s, who are looking at this with a new, fresh perspective. Obviously, women who are in the critical period between the ages of 35 and 45 are going to be the least open to hearing the message that maybe this medicine and procedure may not work. And I understand that denial that might be out there. But truthfully, the more that we open up the discussion, the better off and the better prepared people will be, regardless of the outcome.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, and isn't it, you know, I think you coined the phrase mom, mentor of many, and it's for people like yourself and me and Tracy and other people who are standing out in our story and saying, yes, we tried, we failed to have a child, but we've still got a happy life at the end of it. And that helps, isn't it, to see that you can do that. That's very powerful for other people to see that.
It does. And I think, you know, the real personal challenge that I've had over the course of the last 10 years is the balance, because people always want to take things to the lowest common denominator. And, you know, my real challenge has always been, I don't want to downplay the significance of the sorrow and sadness and anger that results when you don't end up with the child that you once really hoped to achieve and create.
Yeah.
And in that sense, there is this very dark period that most people go through.
Sure.
And I don't want to minimize or put a happy face on that, because it really does require some significant grieving. And much like anyone who loses a dear member of their life, that's a disenfranchised grief. There may not be a tangible baby that you can, you know, point to, but at the same time, that dream is very much alive.
Yeah.
So it is, again, back to the reality, it's a painful, difficult transition, but once you've had the adequate support and acknowledgement, you are in a position to reassess and move forward with your life.
Absolutely. And I think you say that we're all forever changed as a result. And I don't know about you, but I find I've got to the stage now where I'm happy that I'm okay with everything. And for me, childlessness has been a gift in my life, because it gave me the momentum, if you like, or the incentive to make personal changes, so that I'm now happier than I ever have been. And you know, it's like, I think you quote the, is it the finest steel has to go through the hottest fire? I think we've all walked through a hot fire, but we come out, excuse me, forever changed and better at the end of it.
And I think when we're facing any significant shift in our lives, and again, these are all much studied, when there's a huge transformation that occurs at any point in our lives, you know, we have to look hard at that experience and decide, is it going to make me stronger or weaker?
Yeah.
And it's a very difficult and not particularly pleasant experience to have to stare into the darkness and wonder what's on the other side.
Yes.
But, you know, that strength is out there if we are given the appropriate room and tools to work it through. And again, having just a glimmer of light, hearing from other women, the first time that I blogged over 8 years ago and had a response from Australia while I was sitting in the dark in my kitchen in California, my whole world changed.
Yes.
And, you know, when you know you're not alone, it's someone else is mirroring back your difficulty, then you find a hidden source of new momentum to start moving forward.
Yes, I think that the power of Me Too is we can't be underestimated. It's just incredible, isn't it?
It truly is.
Okay. What would be your key takeaway that you'd ask people reading the book and listening to this conversation? What would you wish that people would do as a result of reading or listening?
Well, I think that the most important thing is to just be open to some of these ideas. Mm. It's sometimes easy to want to see the world in black and white.
Yeah.
And certainly the nuance is one that I think it's missed, the complexity to really value individuals regardless of whether or not they've had a chance to parent or not.
Yeah.
I think to provide a path to women and men in the next generation to say, look, this is something we've learned the hard way, right? 35 years later, we have a better understanding today, and we want to put that knowledge to work.
Mm, okay. Well, that was some good things, really excellent. So, yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time. And, speak soon. Okay.
I look forward to it.
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you.